I realize many things are expected of a man, and I would like to believe that I have this Renaissance quality, having spent several years in the city of Florence studying the guild system during the period of Florentine greatness, but I have not been able to produce this morning. I got the lights on, I got the place open, I have even managed to get the air conditioning flowing, I think. But I have not been able to discover where they have put away the loud speaking equipment, and nobody here seems to know. So you are going to have to make do with the technology that we have available. Now we come here to this last day of our deliberations. We have another day tomorrow to return our reports to you. And it's with a sort of a note of sadness, I must say. Coming down the elevator this morning, I met my good friend, Mr. Codant from Ketchikan. He asked me how I was feeling, and I told him, well, I'd been awake for a while, trying to rethink what I should have done differently if I had to do all over again. And there are many things that I would do differently, without doubt. One of them is I'd stick to my first purpose here of dealing with the larger issues. I do think that where sometimes some things went wrong is where I introduced a component into the conference of which I had great expectations and which simply did not come off in this kind of thinking. We are constantly confronted with the necessity of some shock. You are inevitably frozen into a process that is hard to reorient, and yet there comes a time in the history of events when our thinking and our political processes have to be reinstitutionalized, and when they have to be reoriented, this is inevitable. And so mostly this is done over a period of time. It's a matter of evolution, not a matter of revolution. And yet, as I view the Alaskan scene, it sometimes seems that you do stand at a particularly important moment of your history. It's, as George Rogers said yesterday, it's somewhat similar to the point at which you attain statehood, and that it does mark a real milestone in the history of Alaska, and that the things that you do now will have an impact for many, many years to come, that there is a continuing past, we understand. This is part of the future, but that there is a wide open space out there too that's part of your undetermined future, with which we've been working here in the course of this conference. And so there are so many things that have been left undone, or there are many things that have not been done as they might have been done, but still we've tried to do one thing, and that is to create the conditions for a process to take place here. If you go back and review your correspondence with me, I believe that you will find that back there in the very first letter that I wrote to you, I know that in the very first meeting that I had with the members of the Legislative Council here in Anchorage, that I said the same words that George Rogers said to you yesterday, that the Brookings Institution is not the expert institution here. The Brookings Institution cannot even assemble the experts on the outside to come in here. Rather, the Brookings Institution can provide you with the possibilities of a process of policy formulation, and that you, Alaskans, are the experts, and you're the ones that will have to put together the policy's plan. That Brookings is responsible for the quality of the process, without any question. I suppose that Brookings is also responsible for the quality of the product. But that the Brookings Institution is not going to do this. It's going to be you. But the future of Alaska resides in you and in your wisdom. Any policies plan that is produced here is your plan and not the plan of the Brookings Institution. To be sure, there are times when I would like to have imposed some structure on the process and might even have tried, but you resisted and rejected any imposition of structure on it. So we come here to this last day with a real achievement behind you. And there is much work to be done. I was reviewing what seemed to me to some of the things that we have left undone, and one of them was the matter of communications. One of the things that has struck me about Alaska ever since I got here is it's somewhat similar to South Carolina. I suppose we're all seeking similarities here. In South Carolina, everybody knows everybody else, and every pretty girl is your kissing cousin. And you make much of it. We just know everybody. It's a small state, and everybody knew everybody else in South Carolina. Now, Alaska is, of course, the large state, and yet so many of you know each other. Everywhere I go, I find that all of you seem to know everyone else, whether it's in Juneau or whether it's in Fairbanks, or wherever it is, it's very clear. It appears to me that the conditions that prevailed in the ancient states of Greece, that is, the old city-states of Greece, prevail somewhat in the same way here. That is, Alaska, I have come to think of as an agora, or as that was the meeting place. Aristotle said that a city-state, he used the term state, he used the term polis, could be no larger than, in extent, than the reach of a man's voice. His whole point was that communications control the democratic process. And any time that any place got too large and beyond the range of a man's voice, so that he couldn't speak to him, so that every citizen could not get up. The agora was the central part of the city where the people of the Greek city-state met. When a man couldn't get up and say what he wanted to say and be heard, then no longer could the democratic process take place. So that here in Alaska, in this large state, there are so few of you that in a way you have restored the Greek agora by bringing together roughly 100 or 125 people here. The whole state of Alaska has been assembled in microcosm, and you have discussed and disputed the issues that are before the state. But as you view the future, one of the components of the future inevitably is going to be communications. Now, Mr. Hebert has given us several policy documents dealing with that. I'm not quite sure how well we've dealt with it in the course of the conference. It would seem to me, as you anticipate the future of Alaska, and if you take what Paul Ebelsocker had to say to heart, namely that there is this trend in our times toward democratic participation, that you would be tremendously interested in how a telecommunications system could cover Alaska and provide the conditions that you have had here in this meeting, in the course of this conference that we've had here in Anchorage, where by bringing you together in one place, we've produced the conditions of the agora, but where in the future, in order that all the people of Alaska are going to participate in the public affairs of the state, then telecommunications. And this would seem to be a very likely place for you to think about development. Now, in addition to Mr. Hebert's material on telecommunications, and we did have a session on that, and it didn't come off very well. The man who made the presentation is the only man I know who really produced a good telecommunications program in public affairs in the states, and he did a good job of it in a fairly sizable situation, but it didn't come off very well. I don't think we thought about it like we should. But thinking about the future and thinking about the significance of what you have been doing here, the extension of the concept of the agora, or the meeting place where all the citizens of the city-state came together, extending that to the state of Alaska through a telecommunications system, which carried on a deliberate strategy of public information and public debate, this would seem to be something of tremendous concern. Inescapably, communication seems to control the time component and the space component of our society. And my old teacher, Harold Innes, who was at the University of Toronto, wrote three or four books on this whole business of the connections between communications and development, communications and politics. And this would seem to be something which we might think about. And I was prompted to comment on it this morning as we turn now to this last day's deliberations. And we're asking here to hear from Paul Liebelsacher. I asked Paul to take on a tremendously important task. It was part of what I had thought of as a logic to the program. We started out trying to discuss development or non-development for Alaska. We took up the human resources aspect of this. We took up the environmental aspect of it. And here at this last session, we wanted to stress strategies. Certainly, if you're going to deal with development, if you're going to handle human resources, if you're going to control environment, there's a matter of building the institutions with which to do it. And Paul, yesterday, in a most remarkable way, made us aware of how sensitive he is to the realities of change and how these changes are causing the emergence of new movements and new institutions. And Paul, we're deeply indebted to you, and we look forward to hearing from you today.
I thought of your problem and John's of an adequate response at the end of four long seminars and many speeches, how you might write this report, what you might say. And then I was compelled back to a mischievous moment in my life when my then 7-year-old son, his hen has just laid some eggs and the chicks were about ready to come. My wife was about ready to give birth to our fourth child. And this being a rather precocious, observant kid, decided it was time to put Daddy on the spot. And he said, "Dad, how does it happen?" And I knew my moment had come. My wife fled. I got the other younger kids out of the way. And being a professor, I went into my 53-minute bit. And you know how it gets. You dodge the subject for a long time. You speak in abstraction. You become more earnest. And I was ducking my son's piercing eyes by looking upwards in my lecture. But after 50 minutes, I knew that I had to get to the moment of truth. So I, still looking upward and sweating somewhat, earnestly and solemnly, told him how God had engineered the two sexes. And finally, I looked down, and he had a smile on his face that I still worry about. And he had only one word of comment, which was, "Neat."
Yeah.
Well, you know, you'd thought by that age that I might have had that perspective on the subject, too. But words sometimes belie facts, and you put different emotions sometimes into words and different perspectives. I hope you're going to have as quick and as sharp a rejoinder from all the words that have been thrown at you. I told you yesterday, mostly as a way of getting out of it, that today I would talk about specific recommendations, institutional recommendations, because I thought in the meantime there would be an emergency in New Jersey, or I'd be able to pirate a few ideas by sitting in on some of your groups. And again, I woke up at my time plus an hour, it's getting better, 3 o'clock this morning, to kind of go over what one could really recommend as an alien in this environment about what institutional changes or adaptations or innovations you might bring about. And I turn out to be extremely reluctant still at 9 o'clock in the morning. I'm going to duck out on this assignment, but only by an indirection and by making one specific recommendation to this group. Now, give me a chance to build up to it by explaining, you know, some of the things I rejected, some of the thinking that I went through to arrive at this one specific suggestion. I know how disastrous it is for an outsider to make specific recommendations even when he may be on the same general wavelength. And as I indicated yesterday, even when in New Jersey I feel we're going through many of the things that you're going through here. But I was saved from one recommendation. I came up here ready to say, put that $900 million into a trust or foundation, and I discovered that a few other guys had said that and gotten chopped up. And I begin to hear the reasons why he was chopped up, and I respect them. If I interpret rightly, somehow up here you still have confidence in legislatures and the public process, and you don't want to get hung up in some closed corporations with ideas of their own who may come around with the best idea in the first round and then be something you can't get at and change in round 2, 3, and 4. And there is something about the democratic process that we ought to respect. We fear it often. I keep thinking about what our state legislature would do with $900 million right now. I can tell you what they'd do. They would, first of all, avoid what they should do, which is to pass an income tax. They would repeal a couple of other taxes just in time to make it at the next election. And, you know, and then there are a couple of good boondoggles we've been thinking about for a long time. And they would, if they didn't get any of those through, they'd, because they had died fighting each other on the log rolling process. But what you're saying here is, let's have confidence and let's move ahead and make some of these decisions on an ad hoc local basis, which by and large will turn out to make sense. So I withdraw from that one. I was probably talking as a foundation official who couldn't get over once being in a foundation and wanted to have one in Alaska too. So I move away from those rather specific issues and start talking with a little bit more assurance, I think, about where you need to shore up some of your present institutions and your present efforts. I'm not sure exactly what institutional changes you'd make to do that shoring up. Let's leave that again to your pragmatic genius. But here are a few sensitive spots that I see up here. One certainly is on the legislative side, in the development of public policy. I would think that your legislature, like ours, will need every bit of help that it can get. First, to set problems in the proper perspective, and then to have the staff work that can lay out the alternatives and do so with a certain amount of rationality. And I would say, I would hope that your legislators themselves are not exempt from recommendations. That is, they too need to think the problem through here very widely. Our state legislators in New Jersey are beginning to educate themselves to their jobs in ways they never thought of before. They are making trips to other places to see how this and that is done. They're beginning to meet regularly throughout the nation with their counterparts. They're beginning to recognize that they need staff and not just another patronage appointment for one of their relatives, friends, or political workers. Allow that on the side. But basically, the staff work is of a different caliber, and they themselves have to be that staff in many respects. I watch the faltering development of your local institutions up here, and have read a piece still to be published by Vic Fisher and his colleagues, which superficially at least makes a lot of sense to me, describing the great vacuum that exists in the development of your local institutions. In our day, we have to develop local institutions of great strength. And that is not in choice to developing strong central institutions. One of the great fallacies of political thinking has been that if you strengthen one, you weaken another. And we fought a civil war over that fallacy. Now we're beginning to recognize that you need strength at all levels, and simultaneously, you have to develop the central nervous system, the powers and the authorities that go there, and the visions, with also the local adaptations and participation mechanisms. And you can do these things simultaneously. As a matter of fact, if you talk to a biologist or to a physicist or an engineer, he will tell you that any organism or any structure that wants to be large must simultaneously miniaturize. Otherwise, it cannot be large. And the more complex the organism, the more the miniaturization that you see, including the components that go into space travel or any of the mechanisms of advanced technology. And certainly in the human evolution, it has been the development of the miniature as well as that central. And so I look through your elements here and see the process of adaptation that you're going through from the village associations and the councils of elders and the cultural traditions of local control to this rather impersonal kind of 20th century mechanism that we call the corporation, public and private. I would think that you're going to have to experiment with probably many different forms. But do that deliberately and consciously and with proper help. Everything from the participation mechanisms among the natives, adapting to the newer forms of the 20th century, to some of the forms that we've adapted south of this border in our great impersonal corporations, public and private, and seeing how they develop. I'm impressed, for example, one of the great needs here will be to perfect the settlement patterns, even of those few large-scale settlements like Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. You're probably borrowing and scratching for help from the city management profession, the planners, the housers that we've developed. But I think you got to leapfrog a large part of their conventional wisdoms and experience. What we're now beginning to see in the development of Reston, Columbia, the Newtown tradition, and Operation Breakthrough in the federal government is building whole communities as systems engineering of our cities. And this means new conceptions about how you finance these mechanisms. We're discovering, for example, the need for early cash flow, something I think Dick Netzer has been driving at in his presentations, by other words. And it may well be that you'll want to dedicate some of your revenues here to producing the early cash that you will need to do systems development on your communities, buying at the right early time the kind of infrastructure until such time as revenue income and user charges beginning to pay off the capital investment. What you also discover by the new techniques of urban development is that you can stay off the public purse if you have the conception of comprehensive systems development and adequate cash flow, even on a revolving capital basis. Example, Jim Rouse is discovering in building Columbia that he doesn't need all the subsidies that he thought he might have originally, though he'll take a lot more if you give them to him. He discovers that he can create value and recapture that value. That is, by acquiring the land and then siting the improvements and locating commercial, banking, and other interests where they belong in juxtaposition to the people who are living there, you can recapture value and pay off much of the other development. Give an example. He took, I forget which of the oil companies, and down to Columbia, in the middle of a piece of farm territory, he said, that's where you're going to put your service station. And these marketing guys said, are you crazy? And he said, no. In 3 years, that's going to be a prime site. And they said, well, we don't know. He said, not only is that where you're going to locate, but since that's such a prime location, you're going to pay premium revenues on that location because I created the market or will create the market for you. That station now is pumping more gas than any other station on the East Coast. And they're gladly paying the premium revenues for that location. But in the normal way we do urban development, we let the private entrepreneur who has got the capital to go into his venture acquire it, and in many cases, properly saying he's doing the community a favor. But then he siphons off the surplus earnings and appreciated values and appreciated market that are created by the community coming and living in that place. And they don't get the benefit, so that they again have to pay for sewage and water and other costs apart from the earnings that this guy made at that time. Now, I'm not saying we're going to reverse the tables completely and begin exploiting the entrepreneur like the entrepreneur once exploited us. I'm just saying, a theme that I want to repeat, it's a bargaining trade-off world. And we want to get the public into a position to do this kind of intelligent bargaining and trade-offs. And in the cycle of development, it will pay off to the private entrepreneurs as well. We can't go into the business of the quick write-offs of an investment on the assumption that the community is going to go to hell after 7 or 10 years, and this guy is going to be out of it. What we're going to talk about is the maintenance of values through time, and so that the entrepreneur gains regularly an increasing market and an increasing return on his equity investment and on his risk capital. But it is not to be a fast buck, fast deterioration situation. Another place where I conceive you are going to could use some help is in the development of human resources. One naturally tends, when one gets into a windfall profit like the state of Alaska, like Minnesota did years ago with its royalties from the iron mines, of putting it into conventional good things like education. Now, education is one of the most persistently good things conventionally that I know of. But let's face it, education in our day ought not to be invested in without a hard-headed appraisal of its form, its role, its product, and its development. The Guild of Educators, of which I am one, will gladly give you the bill of increasing needs based on a straight line projection of their present circumstance. But frankly, since this is a bargaining society and we consumers have got a right to ask about what the return is on education, let's sit down and bargain with our educators. And right now say, in what way, to what extent are you producing for this society? And the first to cheer are going to be the Young Turks and the students on campus, to have that establishment rocked a little bit by some collective bargaining about the product. Now, I warn you, it's dangerous business to deal with society's most cherished tradition, which is education, along with religion, in these secular terms. And I suppose, therefore, you ought to be a little bit deferential to the bargainer on the other side of the table. But I also would argue strongly that as you now develop the funds and the need to invest in education you begin asking some tough questions. I don't think, for example, a medieval institution ought to survive intact and grow proportionately in a population which is very different in its character. No longer is the book tied by a chain to the wall in the medieval monastery. The book is now diffused throughout all society, and learning takes place as much off campus as on, where the walls are crumbling between the learning on campus and off. And I would think that you would want to ask your educators before you give them more investments, again deferring to them because the return on that investment is about the highest, to begin bargaining with them and asking them the tough questions. And how can they adapt that educational, very vital process to the needs of your time? I would also ask them, by the way, or somebody in the business, to start teaching our population survival. Survival in a human environment. You ever notice how we teach them how to survive in a natural environment? We've got the whole, in zoology, we teach them all the kind of animals there are and how to watch out for them. There's one animal I won't mention in Alaska, but he's been pretty well talked about, too. Now, we haven't talked about the human animals and the various types you have to live with to survive in the human environment. What kind of behavior patterns follow what kind of people and what kind of occupations or situations? And sociology is an emerging subject which is beginning to do that. But even more than that, survival as an individual, as I mentioned yesterday, how do you survive? And not only that, then you add the other quality factors. Survive with a bit of integrity and some quality in the environment about you. This is going to be particularly important, I think, in dealing with two kinds of animals in our human society. One, the obvious case of the isolated culture, which now has to make it in a mainstream which he may not like, but which is forcing itself on his everyday attention. The other is the element of the mainstream, which I someday think needs more education than does the element that is out of the mainstream. Literally, we discover in my community that the blacks know more about the whites than the whites know about the blacks. The poor know more about the rich than the rich know about the poor. The guys who are living in economic security know less about how to survive in raw life than those who are living in raw life itself. And I would say it has to be a mutual process of education, where, as you are here, you're beginning to talk about how one does survive, even if in the mainstream. Another part of the system where I think you need some help, as we all do, is in the regulation not only of natural resources but of the service industries. The point I got at yesterday. You're now in a society, an extractive situation where people want what you got, what lies beneath your soil, and in your circumstance. They're going to come after it. And I think you're going to have to take a look at whether you are adequately staffed to deal with those who are coming after you. And I would point especially to your regulatory agencies. I happen to know nothing about them, but let me guess. My guess is that they probably look like some of our regulatory agencies in my state. And particularly is this difficult in the services where the tradition has been self-regulation. Doctors regulate doctors. Barbers regulate barbers. Utility companies indirectly regulate utility companies. Lawyers regulate lawyers. Beauticians regulate beauticians. Now, if I'm wrong, I'll shut up right now. But if I'm right, the point gets to be that we'd better get into that regulatory process another and other points of view. I mentioned the 360 degrees yesterday. What we need, for example, in the medical side right now are some enlightened consumer representatives, and I don't mean enlightened just with PhDs or whatever, but people who have thought from their circumstance about the practice of medicine and medical needs. And then in the regulatory process, they have their say with the doctors who are also going to regulate from the point of view of they know what education is required and the rest. It is a bargaining situation. It is a trade-off situation. But I warn those who are self-regulating that they are the first fortresses to come under attack of the enlightened new generation or of the consumer who is now walking very powerfully and aggressively in our times. And the best way to handle this is to bring in early in the process the points of view which later can only take militant and sometimes actually military posture. Another point, then, to continue that is that you need help, as we all do, in bargaining with the outsider. I've mentioned the bargaining with outside industries, the professions. You're now also going to have to bargain with Japan, the Soviet Union, with other economic interests south of this border, with Canada. You're the crossroads, as we all are. Let's not try to call ourselves unique. We're all the crossroads of the world. I happen to have spent a good deal of time in Japan, not enough to know it well, but enough to know that it is important that when you deal with the Japanese, you know their internal politics and needs and pressures and financial mechanisms and power groups as well as they know them themselves. Let me warn you, they know yours. They've been working at this for generations. 10 years ago, I was doing some technical assistance with the Japanese, with the industrial elite and with the government, and they already had people working on Alaska a long time ago. They know this system very well, and I'd be very surprised if the Soviets don't have a cadre of at least 50 social, physical, scientists, economists, and so forth, who have cased Alaska but well, and probably know as much about your operations as you do yourself. Do you know the operations of Japan and the corporations? Do you know who is who and what their needs are? Do you know, for example, that there is constantly a controversy in Japan, a tug of war, between the southern merchants and industrial class who have always oriented to China, who are very anxious to renew the what they regard as the more basic ties with the mainland, but since the war have had to give up to Tokyo and to the class who are inhabiting the western part, the northern part of Japan, orienting in this direction. And there was always a northern component that had oriented to Manchuria and Soviet Union. And this was cut off by earlier developments, but the willingness and the readiness to adapt in that direction is there. Now, I'm oversimplifying, but it is terribly important that Alaska be in a position, not just because it happens to have one industry that happens to know the Soviet Union, but Alaska as a state knows another element of power and must come into a position of bargaining with it. Terribly important that you get help to here, and I don't know how to prescribe for this, in public leadership. We've begun to realize the importance of having men in public office who are speaking from something else than a sectional interest, and who are able to verbalize and articulate, if not the solutions of the times, the problems of the times, in that same rounded way. You'll have none of the things are going to work in this society, none of the institutions will do it, unless there is someone in the executive and people in the legislature who are there talking for all of Alaska and who are saying we're going to look at these problems in the 360-degree round that I described yesterday. Now, I said I was going to limit my recommendations, and I could go on in a parade of other places where you and we all need help. Limit the recommendations to one specific. Let me tell you where that specific comes from. Came from originally from when I was teaching at Swarthmore, and suddenly out of the blue I got a call from Joe Clark, then the mayor of Philadelphia, later the senator, and Joe said, I just lost my executive secretary, and would you think of coming down working at it? And he mentioned the salary, which was twice what I was getting at Swarthmore. That was pretty compelling. but mostly the excitement of going down and working with a guy whose mind I respected. When I got there, we talked it out. He had made a choice, he said, between a newspaper man who would be kind of old shoe and taking a shot on a long hair from the campus who, he didn't know what the payoff might be. And I asked him, fine, I said, well, Mayor, what's the job? He said, hell, I don't know. It's this, it's that. What does a secretary do? And he turned kind of helplessly to his associates, and one of them said, you should be the Charlie Murphy of the City Hall. He had worked in the White House, and he'd never forgotten that. Each guy had it in his own image. One fellow who was very bright and wanted me out of the way said that I should become the solitary thinker of the administration and should have an office down the hall. that syndrome. Well, finally, Joe said, well, I'll tell you what it is. He said, I want you to help fight the battle for my mind. And that was the most challenging thing I have ever been offered. And what I'm talking now about is helping fight the battle for Alaska's mind. This is the thing I want to make a recommendation about. Now, the form, I suppose, in which it would take would be, call it an Alaskan fellowship. And now I think you know where I'm going. I don't think I should spend time talking about mechanics of institutions that you can invent better than I, and that we'll have to develop as human beings live pragmatically with clear-eyed statements of problems. The best way to fight for the mind and to transmit values and energies is through people. And one thing you can do now, or at least that I could recommend doing, and doing it with whatever monies you have at your disposal, it'll be a relatively small amount, is to begin concentrating on mining and importing and developing these human resources. Youthful in spirit, I'm talking largely about the younger generation and how you're going to capture them. Who will they be? Well, let me say before I go on to that, the idea I should have mentioned also partly comes from the work I've been doing with industrial corporations and in our own state this last 15 years. 15 years ago, I began meeting with Bell executives, the vice presidents of AT&T, then it later grew to Western Electric, the Alcoa, the Meade Paper Corporation, and probably about 15 or 20, in which I keep coming back and meeting with their executives. And I've noticed something. Take Western Electric. They bring on their younger, bright guys. They recruit on campus for them. And then they invest in these guys regularly with executive development right on through. You go to Princeton now and they have a campus, a research and development unit, and a university for their young executives. And they take these young fellows, 35 years of age or so, when they know they're going to become the vice presidents, and they put them for a year into this circumstance, without wife, by the way. The wife can visit a couple times during that period of time. But they really go at them. And what do? They stretch them from every direction. They send Black Panthers in, Black Muslims, ex-communists. And not only that, they'll send John Birchers, and then the best writers in the business, into this group, and keep pounding them. They make them go to plays on Broadway, like Hair, in which some of these guys, by the way, since the Bell system and Western Electric usually recruit the middle-class, solid-type citizen in our society, it's pretty rocky for these guys emotionally. But they begin getting them used to having to live life in this kind of round, the result of which I would guess that AT&T, the Bell system, is one of the most adaptive and most best at the business of pragmatism of any of the industrial corporations I know. And you know that if I took my executives in New Jersey once to a isolated place where I had to pay more than $15 a day per dime and put them on, for a martini at night, I'd be crucified by the legislature. And yet our guys are far more important than those Western Electric guys in the development of our society and of our economy. But I want to make clear that I'm talking not just about people going into the public service. Yesterday I tried to indicate I think it's important that we try to go after people in all walks of life to develop the capacity to handle public problems with all the mutual consents and the other kinds of things that are required. So therefore, when I talk about recruitment, I'm not talking about trying to get some indentured servants who faithfully must come back after they've gone through this experience and be a city manager or a bureaucrat number three in the wildlife division or something like that. I'm talking about your young citizenry who are going to be your industrialists, who are going to be your doctors, who are going to be your public servants, who are going to be your native leaders, and all the rest. And to begin investing deliberately in this kind of a person who is needed in the 20th and the 21st century to do the kind of job that Alaska faces. I would obviously go into your native communities and try to pick out those self-standing people who've got the potential, and then without saying you have to join mainstream, let them get the ingredients of choice of saying whether they keep their native culture and learn in the 20th century how to do it, or go into the achievement 20th century business in the mainstream that has become conventional for us. I would also, by the way, go outside your border. You're down recruiting industrialists and firms and everybody else. Why not deliberately recruiting that generation throughout the United States that is ready to crack problems like this? You're getting a few. They're self-chosen, and by the way, the self-chosen are usually the best. But this doesn't mean that you have to stay simply with the self-chosen and the accidental process by which this happens, in which they come up here and sometimes get buried in one perspective on Alaska and one occupation. But bring them on up from down below with, if you want, call it the Alaskan Fellowship. I heard yesterday, and it was kind of sad, that there was a proud statement about three Alaskan kids are about ready to be selected as Rhodes Scholars, or at least have got a chance for the first time. I think that's great. But what about yourself? Why aren't you, instead of attracting to Cambridge, why aren't you attracting here to Alaska these types, by the way, which are now in surplus supply south of your border? Matter of fact, they're hanging around campuses and creating, in many respects, sour expressions of their energy. But as I say in our internship program in New Jersey, when we open it up to these kids, by the way, the legislature is paying for this. We open up to these kids, legislature couldn't get, first of all, I had to fight every year for it the first 2 years because they thought that this was a Democratic governor candidate who was about building up his own field workers, you know, his political staff. They'd been through this so many times that they weren't going to have any more of that. But when they began discovering who these kids were and the jobs they were doing, and the fact that they couldn't get their own kids in unless they could beat competition, it has changed. And last year we had 1,200 applications for 200 positions. This year it'll go between 2,000 and 3,000. It's harder to get into our internship program than it is to get into Harvard right now. And the people we get are just extraordinary. You can do the same. You can recruit from this pool of this fantastic generation the best if you just go after it. The recruitment, therefore, inside, outside, in your native groups, and certainly one of the least privileged in our society are the sons of the privileged. I think you know what I mean. They're cut off from a cause, because what cause can they fight for except to dump the old man? And they've everything else is kind of had. They get their education paid for, and they don't want it paid for quite that way. But I've discovered that this group of kids are just as good as the natives that we work from, the migrant streams, and tremendous complementarity. Turns out that they find more common cause, the kids of the affluent and the kids of the poor, than some of the others who are in the middle class struggling on. So recruitment should be inside and outside. What about training? I think our internship in New Jersey gives some example here of what can be done. Assign them to places where there is plenty of work to be done, where they're very close to decision makers, people who have got influence and have to make up their minds. Structure it partly, but not entirely, because part of the genius is to allow unstructured work to go forward. Put them close to where none of us know the answers, because the most energy is unleashed when there is the challenge of the unknown. Put them in a routine assignment. Well, it's all right to teach them a little bit of the discipline that the monastery has always taught, but that is not also a good growing room for very long. And the placement then, obviously. Some can be placed in industry. As a matter of fact, I would choose, if I run this program, that they get rotating assignments over a longer period of time, and that they go into industry, to the oil business, they go into the pulp business, they go into whatever is current and choice and necessary here, and they know that industry better than the guys in that industry themselves. Because if they're going to have to come up against that industry in a bargaining position, they have to know it, and you can't allow in our society damn nonsense or damn foolishness. I'm kind of tired of the loss of time when naive people take on difficult systems, or naive people in charge of difficult systems take on the difficult social circumstances out of which naivety sometimes comes. We've got to know well what the guy we're bargaining with has to contend with in order to come to an effective contract. So industry is one. I would certainly put them into an adversary role. Go through the experience of providing the necessary staff for, you have the Alaska Native Federation, for village groups who are struggling to learn how to deal with the 20th century, who are dealing all the way up to land claims and need good legal help. But put them in an adversary position and know what it is like to try to work against City Hall or the establishment as part of their experience. In the legislature, because I think that there is no place I know where realities come together in such a final way as before the legislature in the public process. Local governments are obvious. This is the place to put a lot of them right now. You're going to have a very difficult time recruiting city managers or personnel to your present system for a variety of reasons. One, you don't have many, so there's not much of a future for a guy who makes it in one place to go to the next. Second, the structure isn't that big or that exciting yet. It doesn't have yet the capital flows, all the rest of those problems. But if you tie your recruitment into this kind of a program, you're going to get a revolving through those institutions of first-rate abilities. Another place to put them certainly is in the regulatory commissions. You can see how I'm harping on that. I think we can save Civil War in the 1970s if we begin to get the evolutionary changes moving faster within our guilds and professions and the trade unions and the rest, so that you put some of this younger ability as staff to some of your regulatory commissions. I would also send them abroad. I think you ought to have this cadre of people be as at home in Tokyo and in Moscow as in New York, as in Washington, as in Anchorage. Again, the network principle. You've noticed how effective it is for the industrial group who have this kind of mobility. Now, why don't we get what has been a static tradition also dynamized in the public sector of having personnel who are this sophisticated? And I would also put them in the university, teaching, but particularly also in research institutes, so that they can get the feel of what it is to take a problem in a dispassionate way and yet produce a report which is relevant. The aim of this Alaskan Fellowship, or the process, and by the way, there are many ways you can do this. Whoever structures this will have to live with it pragmatically, talking about what age groups, how to involve women, at what stages in life does it make sense to do certain things, a lot of these, and also within the university, how to get credit for this operation. We're doing this, by the way, in our operation. I've got more dropouts from universities and colleges now working with us than you can shake a fist at, and you know what they're doing? They're calling up their faculty about in August when they took on the summer internship, and they say, hey, can we stay here for the fall? We're learning more than we are on campus. Now, that's a poor way to approach the university. And they're even learning to say it a little better than that, which is, what you have taught us is really coming to fruition here. As a result of this,